It is Saturday, November 19th, 2011. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. If you'd like to participate in making a theme for GeekSpeak, please do so and send us a note. We'd love to play your music. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons share and share alike. In the second half of the show, I'll invite you to participate in the conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like about technology or make a comment. The phone number is 800-655-5877, and I'll give out that information again in about 20 minutes. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Miles, I think the most important thing for me this week was a little bill that's in Congress, and it's making its way through Congress, that looks really bad. Can you explain
what's... For the second time, yes.
Yeah, can you explain what SOPA is?
SOPA is an acronym that stands for the Stop Online Privacy Act. And there's actually an analog to that called Protect IP in the other House of Congress.
Stop Online Privacy. It seems a little weird.
Piracy.
Piracy. Thank you very much. I thought you said privacy. Okay.
I'm terribly sorry. Stop Online Piracy Act.
And this is mostly funded and organized by large controllers of content.
It's Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah.
But to a large extent.
Now, we have had for years problems with people that own large copyright collections having this dilemma where people are downloading them for free and therefore money's not being made, and this whole piracy space is
right,
very alive and well.
The peer-to-peer, whether it be BitTorrent or LimeWire.
And we've seen a lot of companies come up and get strong and decrease again. We've seen a lot of...
We saw Napster taken down in the late 90s.
Right. And Apple's response, of course, is just to make a very simple site to buy stuff. They're clearly making good money.
And they are now the largest online retailer of music.
I think they're the largest retailer of music, period, online or not. And they don't have copyright infringement. I mean, they don't have copy blocking content. So Apple used to encrypt all their files and make it very hard to play it if you weren't the person that was intended to play it. Now all their content is open. You can buy a song. You get it as a couple different file formats from Apple site, and you could email that file to me. So it's very easy to actually share that content. They're not trying to put in the technical blockades, mostly because those technical blockades don't work over periods of time. People can do this.
Very short periods of time, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. And there's always, of course, the analog hole where you just play a file and record it.
Yeah. You've used the term analog hole. I do have to say I still hate that term with a passion. Analog hole means reality. to say that
if you can experience something, then you can record that experience.
Right. That the idea of it's an analog hole is like saying that records are nothing, albums, LPs are nothing but a hole. There's no content to them. There's no...
So the point is that a technical solution to this problem of trying to figure out how to enforce a social norm, which would be if somebody's making content and you want to keep and you want to support them, you actually pay somehow for that content.
Right. And a lot of this was covered by the Additional Millennium Copyright Act, which we've talked about on the show before and had some issues with. But at the same time, in speaking with different people like Cruz.io, folks over there, and
local
a couple of copyright lawyers, that for them, things end up being kind of easy because it's a straightforward, here's the procedure, here you go through this, and...
The current state of affairs before the SOPA law passing is that if a user on YouTube uploads a video of their kid, and in the background of that video of the kid playing with their toys, there's a song by Janis Joplin playing, that if the owner of the copyright of that song sees the video and says, hey, this isn't appropriate, and sends a notice to YouTube, YouTube has to take it down, has to respond to that notice in a certain period of time. And if they do, they haven't broken any laws.
Right. That's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
That's
not
the current. That's the current state of affairs, yeah. Which seems like a relatively fair thing. There's some side effects of that anybody can kind of send a stop and assist to any provider, and it gets kind of complicated.
But it does create a safe harbor. It means that YouTube is not responsible for the posts of its users. It's merely when they're notified that there's an infringement, then it becomes their responsibility to take it down. But they are not responsible for trying to police it or proactively censor things.
This new bill is a very different beast.
Very different beast indeed.
So let's talk about what now can YouTube expect if under this law, if somebody does that same thing, what could YouTube be hit with?
YouTube is one example where someone puts up copywritten content because the entire website is YouTube.com. There's no differentiation between the different users per se. It's more just like the different URLs. You really can't tell from V equals ZXY39. Right.
There's no URL space that defines the users. Even though each file that you actually play, it tells you what user uploaded it.
Right. YouTube would then lose safe harbor status, and they would be subject to whatever any of their users had done. So this would be like someone uploads that video of their kid with Prince in the background or Janis Joplin, or something like that, and then they have to take it down. They are subject to the possibility that the U.S. government will just say, hey, we're taking your domain.
So
you can't. So people cannot get to your site anymore.
Okay. So there's the domain control thing, but it also supports the idea that the owner of the copyright could sue YouTube, even though YouTube just allowed a user to post something.
Yes, but the big issue that people have been talking about is the fact that you're able to shut down or block websites. The idea that this bill allows government censorship.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a what people are describing as a fairly clear-cut First Amendment and Fourth Amendment issue, and possibly others, possibly even Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. Like something happens and you suddenly have your entire, livelihood taken away in the split second, even though you personally had nothing to do with it. Someone happened to post on your site because you have a forum.
Right.
And this would apply actually to any forum out there. So if you are in a community like Reddit, then you post something, Reddit's liable.
The reason so dangerous, of course, is that the basic idea now is that people have been kind of responsible for their own content, and a service provider, a website, isn't really responsible for the content that's up there unless they don't respond.
Right. They're a common carrier. They're like a telephone. You don't sue the telephone company because two people plot over the phone to plant a bomb somewhere.
Right. What about, is a newspaper kind of akin to this? Because, of course, in a newspaper, traditionally, the newspaper publisher is responsible for all the content in there. We're switching more to that model.
Newspapers are a little different. They are subject to, I am not a lawyer, they're subject to libel laws.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they also almost always have a centralized editorial staff.
They do.
And so you do have that gatekeeper for everything that comes out. There's a proactive dissemination of information by that one entity, as opposed to having something like a blog engine, whether it be Blogger or LiveJournal. If someone put up copywritten content on one of those, it would be the equivalent of you're taking down an entire association of companies because one reporter in one newspaper did something illegal.
Right. So this is the blocking of the part that's kind of freaky is the blocking of content. The reason why it's so damaging is the world that we know right now of our online space, where you can go up to YouTube and you can watch a whole bunch of different people try to sing pop songs, and we got to keep in mind that even like Justin Bieber's existence is because of his YouTube videos as a kid playing popular music. It wasn't his
singing along with it. Yeah,
some of it was, but some of it was him singing, other people's music. And so because of that, because he didn't have license rights, that content wouldn't have gone up in this new space. We won't have that kind of scenario. So it really fundamentally changes how what we know of as the internet right now works. And it's so hard to say, this law will break the internet.
Right.
But it's right in there.
And to give it a personal bent, just so you know exactly what we're talking about if you don't understand the technology so much.
Yeah.
Imagine you have a answering machine, not voicemail, like good old days of answering machines.
Sure.
And you are now liable for whatever message someone leaves on your answering machine.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well,
someone calls, you have a public number that someone can call in, and someone leaves a message, and because that message is left, you now have your phone number taken away.
Okay. It's not exactly true, because you're not republishing that content. It's about putting the content up.
That's
no
true.
One knows
that's
where
true.
It is. So it's more like if you're a grocery store and you have a bulletin board system outside and people can post flyers about lost dogs and stuff. Somebody comes along and posts a picture of a copyrighted work on your wall and you lose your building.
Very good. Yes.
That's
what we're talking
about.
Analogy.
And that's what we're talking about. And so what will happen is the content that we currently can share very widely and easily just won't be there anymore. The YouTubes won't do what they do. You know?
Right.
And keep in mind, Google's against this. Microsoft's against this. Yahoo's against this. And it's not because they
are in favor of copyright infringement. They're not.
Right, right. It's much more that this law is just doing it wrong. Okay, next.
Well, a great deal of overreach as well. This idea of if you have, someone can just say, hey, we're going to block this person. Because there doesn't even have to be a warrant. There doesn't have to be a legal precedent. Just someone has to make a corporation has to make a copyright claim against the domain for it to be taken down.
Yeah, that's the thing that's freaky is that it's not, it doesn't seem like, to enforce this is going to be very difficult. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
And it also leads itself very strongly to abuse. What happens if you have someone who's a whistleblower that wants to talk about a company and the company asserts that it's a copyright or a trade secret, even though it is still in the public interest, even though it is absolutely true. And for a newspaper, it would be totally clear of any libel laws because it's true information,
at least
in the U.S.
The thing that's so strange about this is that we have fundamental ideas of our country about free speech. And this it directly says the government's going to start dealing with speech issues.
Right. And as we mentioned before on the show many times, the fact that it's in digital space makes it
different somehow?
Well, it makes it easier to pass this type of legislation because a lot of folks don't understand the issue as well.
I think that, okay, so there's a lot of people using Facebook, right?
Yep.
And Facebook's a perfect example of this. If you did, do a little video clip of your kids in a school play and you wanted to share some of that with a Facebook group, I'm not even talking about public. I'm talking about like a subgroup in Facebook that you're using. Yeah, that's not going to happen anymore, right? Those things that you're taking for granted so far, because Facebook and all these companies won't be able to trust what their users are doing, meaning that they won't know, an average user doesn't know what's copyrighted, what's not, right? You take a picture with somebody and the Coca-Cola logo's on their t-shirt, don't put that online. That's a trademarked logo. You don't have the right to reuse that. And so because of that complexity, the service providers are just going to have to drastically change how they provide these services to people.
Right. And it's not just about putting up filtering.
Right.
The amount of content going up on Facebook, going up on YouTube, you don't have enough, you can't hire enough people to police that.
That's the other thing is that the amazing thing about the internet has been this regrowth of personal creativity. Now there is so much work being generated. People aren't sitting and watching the TV all the time. They're now editing Wikipedia. They're now making little videos and uploading them. They're having dialogue about everything under the sun. And all of that is because of this free and open space that we have, this community forum that's global. And these laws are going to drastically change it. And it's all, it's only in the U.S. No, it's not. It's the U.S.'s control and effect of the internet is very overreaching.
And that's one of the other major side effects that I don't know if the people who are pushing this legislation appreciate, which is with regard to DNS, the domain name service, it's
the thing that translates yahoo.com or geekspeak.org into a location, a real location.
Series of numbers. Yeah.
Right.
It's the internet phone book.
Mm-hmm.
You look up a name, you get the phone number. You look up a name in DNS, you get back an IP address. And it is currently controlled by ICANN and it's controlled by a U.S.
nonprofit
entity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that has caused some wrangling with people in other countries because the U.S. has so much control there.
Right.
Because that company is within U.S. jurisdiction. And if you start having sites getting blocked by the U.S.
Right. This is the domain name service thing that's really interesting. What we've been talking about so far is like the order of the government to shut down a website. You know, take that down. Mm-hmm. It's gone. The other thing
we're talking about the technical mechanism now.
Yeah, basically they would be able to remove a person's name or a site's name from the phone book, and therefore mm-hmm. no one will be able to know where it goes. The thing is, they will. This is the other part about this, is that this law, for people that want to break the rules, they can break it easily. That's the thing that's really frustrating about this as well.
Right, and as time goes on, and a very short time actually, as sites get blocked, you're going to see more and more software get released that allows someone who doesn't have any computer experience whatsoever to press a button, and they now have access to all those sites again.
So the ICANN thing, the root level domain controlling entity, allows your machine to figure out where every website is by name. And this is going to make it so that if geekspeak.org is infringing and the U.S. government decides to take our domain away, they just do it, no one can use geekspeak.org. So because of that, the users that would want to get to geekspeak.org, I'm going to go on air and say, well, this is our IP address, or we've moved our domain to a new domain. Now it's geekspeak2.org. And I can do that every single day. And assuming people that are wanting to participate in the dialogue in that site could keep going to a different domain. But the thing that would be getting hard to manage, and so we'd start seeing software that allow you to register a domain space, and it would basically translate for you on the fly.
Or more specifically, it would write to your host file.
Right. It would basically totally copy what DNS is supposed to do.
It'd actually go back to what the internet was like before DNS.
That's right. We had to pass the domain files. Yeah.
You had just a series of files that you shared among different people to say these are where different spots are. What it's also likely to cause is other countries to say, well,
here's a
screw
root domain
this.
Servers.
We don't want to use you anymore. We're going to set up our own.
Yeah. Which actually might be good.
Because one domain service may have a name set to one IP address, that's and another true. Domain service may have it set to another.
But you would think that a large or group
that's
of
one. That's one of the reasons why you have ICANN, is that you do want to have a central authority to say, here's where the root of the tree is.
I bet you could do a distributed authority situation. I bet there's a way to do that.
This might. You just have
that.
To...
It's complicated. I get that.
Yeah, everyone has to agree upon it.
Yeah.
Agree upon usage of it. And if you take away the generally agreed upon route right now,
yeah,
I find it highly unlikely that the world is going to coalesce around a new route.
Granted, but keep in mind Bitcoin, right? A distributed money system where there is no central authority and the whole thing works. And that's
actually it's running
it's
into a lot of
well.
Problems. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not running into technical problems, is it?
There are some technical issues, and the amount of
transactions is causing a problem.
Transactions is causing a problem.
Well, let's there's one other the other thing about this is that currently, if you do infringe someone's copyright and they feel they've got a good case against you, they take you to court. They have a lot of lawyers, and you settle out of court for some serious money. So your kid goes ahead and starts sharing a whole bunch of content, a movie or something, to his friends, streaming it somehow, and you get hit with a lawsuit from the copyright owners, or actually a corporate lawyer's firm that attacks you, and you have to settle out of court for whatever your family can afford. This happens all the time. It's kind of slowed down the last year and a half, but it's a regular thing. In this new scenario, yeah, that's a felony offense. It's not like it's a copyright infringement and it's a litigation, it's a lawsuit. This is a felony now in this rule. That scares me.
Yeah, and let's be clear, I actually don't believe that Facebook or YouTube are going to get sued out of existence.
No, but they wouldn't be able to start.
Because those large companies are a moneymaker for a lot of spots, whether through ads or through being able to disseminate their content
this
regularly.
This is the finer detail of this problem.
Right. So you'll have big companies making licensing agreements with music companies or movie studios. But it means that you're going to have an oligopoly, meaning that smaller people who are just making a new startup, who don't have the deep pockets, who can't make the big deals, will be shut out.
Of course, the film industry, the music industry does not want YouTube to go away, right? What they want is they want to use that power. So every one of those copyright owners, if you will contact YouTube and say, hey, whenever you can detect one of our songs, here's our song profiles, give us a free ad. As soon as you do that, then you can do anything you want on the site. that licensing agreement, it's the same kind of licensing agreement that radio stations have been doing for years, right? KOSP can play any music we want. We don't have to talk to every artist. We don't have to talk to every copyright holder because we grow to a large organization called BMI, which then collects money from lots of users. We log who we play, and that money theoretically gets back to the owner and the artist. And that's why how radio station functions.
And relative to the size of your audience.
Right. Yeah. But if you and I, Miles, want to make our own radio station from our home, we don't have that kind of power and strength. We can't play that stuff. And so it becomes...
And we don't have the funds to be able to license through BMI.
That's right. So we're in a very sticky situation, and this is just going to cause more centralization of internet powerhouses, if you will. There will be no new YouTube websites. Okay. We can go to our site, geekspeak.org, and learn all about this. You can go to americancensorship.org to learn more about this. Well, we've taken about 20 minutes talking about it. I guess we care about this, don't we?
Yeah, we've sometimes tend toward hyperbole about some issues that have been in the past. This is one that is worth people's attention.
I agree. Well, should we do one more before the break? I think we will. You want to talk about X-rays? I'm curious.
I wanted to go kind of geeky.
Yeah, go ahead.
We had some comments from listeners saying that we need to go back to our roots, go back to our geekiness, back to some of those old stories. So I'm going to go to my bread and butter, which is the web, and talk about a new technology called WebGL. WebGL being...
It's not that new.
Well, considering the fact that Internet Explorer still isn't supported.
Yeah, okay.
It's a 3D technology. It's based upon, or actually could be used for 2D as well, but it's based upon another standard known as OpenGL, which is very common on Macs and is available on Windows as well. OpenGL is also a direct competitor to DirectX or Direct3D. And it's an extension to HTML's new canvas tag, which is straight 2D graphics, whereas WebGL, you're not just drawing to a 2D canvas, you're actually interacting with some of the primitives on your video card, on the GPU, that graphics processing unit. One of the issues with that, though, is it's running in a web browser. Many of you, especially if you've been using web browsers for a while, you know that web browsers can be a little slower than some of your native apps. Luckily, browsers are getting a lot faster, and nowadays you're using the newest versions of Firefox or Chrome or Opera, and you're amazed by how fast some of the things you can do. Well, how fast are they getting? Well, one company decided that they wanted to try out, a company called Sira, wanted to try out how far are we from actually doing real games on a browser. And they actually have a renderer that is based and that is in C++ and DirectX that they use as a baseline. And they have a canvas, a 2D renderer that they use in a browser as another baseline that they were using. And now that WebGL is starting to come into its own, starting to have real support of a large number of browsers getting it, they ported their engine to WebGL to see how that would
function. So two canvas interactions. One is a 2D canvas interaction, one's a WebGL. Well,
one is a software rendering, which is what canvas is, and one is being accelerated by the GPU,
which
is WebGL.
Okay. And then DirectX, of course, is using DirectX connections to the browser.
DirectX being like every game that you've ever played on Windows. And the performance that they come out with it is rather impressive. Well, let's start off with Canvas, just the software rendering. That one, IE9 does support.
What were they rendering? What were they creating? What was the imagery?
They were measuring how sprites can get onto the screen. Sprites being, you take
small
an image.
They move around.
Yeah, if you played Super Mario Brothers, for example, the picture of Mario is a sprite. The picture of the cloud is a sprite.
The turtle.
Yeah,
the duck.
Sprite. Yeah.
All that stuff, right? Everything in that game is little sprites being moved around.
And figuring out where they collide or where they interact, where they intersect. And
Pac-Man is another good example of that.
Yes, an excellent example. And you just translate the sprites like one to the next one that shows an animation.
Right. So, yeah, Pac-Man is something like 9 frames of its mouth opening and closing, opening, closing.
Right.
And then it rotates. You know, it's like really simple sprite interaction.
Mm-hmm. Internet Explorer 9 does support Canvas 2D, which is the software renderer. It's a layer in between JavaScript and
so all modern browsers video support card. This ability.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is good news. And they do pretty well. They're trying to figure out how many sprites you can get at 30 frames per second. 30 frames
so
per second being about TV.
If you're generating like asteroid game where you have all these different asteroids in a ship and little bullets of moving light blowing up things, mm-hmm. trying to render that, getting how many different sprites do they deal with?
Well, IE9 can get about a little over 4,500.
That's a lot.
Yes. Chrome can get a little over 4,000, Firefox a little over 3,000. So IE9 is very impressive on that front.
On the sprite drawing in the browser.
In Canvas, in
and
the software renderer.
This is the same hardware, so that they had the same profile, if you will.
Yes.
I'm assuming.
Yes, the exact same hardware. So they tried it out with the WebGL renderer. Fortunately, IE9 doesn't support that.
So everyone feels
but
sure.
They use that as a baseline to see, you know, so they're a little over 4,500 sprites. To be able to run at 30 frames per second. Chrome running with WebGL instead of Canvas, or instead of straight 2D Canvas, using the GPU, gets over 14,500.
Wow. Not bad.
So in other words, it's... It's
quite a bit more.
3.5
okay,
times
faster.
As fast.
And this is not generating 3D space. This is just using the OpenGL library, WebGL library,
well,
to put a whole bunch of sprites on the screen.
Dealing with vertexes.
Right, right.
The points to a,
right.
an object.
Okay.
Or the boundaries.
So it does
object.
Better.
Much better. Okay. And Firefox, the newest version of that, is just shy of 8,000.
Okay, so twice as fast.
So twice as fast
or, as... Wasn't it Firefox at 3,000 sprites?
Yeah.
Yeah, so three times as fast as it. So not amazing numbers, but good. How did...
Well, that's the thing, though, is that they are getting quite fast. But
what's the DirectX do?
But DirectX, on the other hand, when they were... let's be fair to Opera. Opera has a new alpha version. It's not a release version mm-hmm. yet, but theirs gets 21,000.
Better than the other. That's nice.
Yeah, noticeably better. Second place being 14,500, a little over 14,500, which is Chrome.
Right. Okay, so just be clear, that's a lot of... asteroids. You wouldn't be able to play a game like that. But this would be for particle effects kind of things, right? You throw an object
right.
in a pool and splash of water, that kind of idea that the machine is drawing a whole bunch of separate entities every 30
right.
times
if you
second.
Want to play asteroids or Pac-Man, these are very much overkill. What we're talking about is getting into the realm of the 3D games, like
right.
the Modern Warfare games or the...
Right. We're not talking about Angry Birds. Yeah. All these things can handle
or the
Angry
newer
Birds.
Flight simulators or
all
things
these,
like that.
All these browsers, all these things we've talked about can handle Angry Birds no problem, right? Because you've
right.
got maybe up to 30 things moving on the screen, right? All the blocks, maybe a little bit more, but not in the 3,000 range. We're
right.
talking about first-person shooter games. That's pretty cool.
That have all these textures and sure. all, yeah. So, DirectX with Raw C++, a little over 85,000.
Yeah, okay.
So four or five times the speed.
Now, wait, what
but,
hardware do they use? Because some hardware is better DirectX than OpenGL. And OpenGL is the default behind it, right?
They were using Intel Core i5
mm-hmm.
At 3.3 gigahertz, 8 gigs of RAM, and
what was the card?
Reasonably good video card, AMD Radeon HD 6500 with 1 gig of VRAM. That's running on top of Windows 7 64-bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, like, oh, well, the native is five times faster. That's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
But do you remember when we were getting updated video cards
yeah.
From Sean on a regular
sure.
basis? And I'd get a card where I'm saying, well, how much faster is this than the card that I already had? And he goes, oh, well, the card you had was horrible. So this is the new hotness. And this is 10 times faster than what you had before. Like, oh, okay. Well, that's good. I had a mid to low range card before, and now I have a top of the line card.
Sure,
like it
sure.
made a big difference. Then a few months later, he'd say, oh, there's a new top of the line card. Here, try this out.
Same
well, how much faster is this? It's about six times faster. What? Yeah. 6 months later, he goes like, well, here's another new top of the line card. What? Well, how much faster is this? Well, it's three to five times faster than the last one that I gave you.
Right.
So five times faster really isn't target distance for what you can do. I mean, we're talking about these browsers now on a reasonable system have the power of what we expected for a console like the PlayStation 3, which we thought were tremendously powerful when they were released, you know, half a decade ago.
So are we seeing games at that level? Are we going to see the next, you know, first-person shooter being released for browser?
Well, there's the question. When you have a game developer deciding, well, do I want to code this for a console? Do I want to code this for the Mac? Do I want to code this for the PC? And how do I want it? Or they can say, I'm going to code this for WebGL, and it works everywhere.
Without install.
Without install.
Yeah.
Well, you probably would have to have some level of install because you'd have to download huge assets. But yeah. But you are still talking about one code base.
Right. Which is important. In just a second, Miles Elam, who's in the house with me, will tell us our geek bit, which I think is a quote today. But I just want to let you know first that you can call us with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. My name is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data, storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com.
Science. If you don't make mistakes, you're doing it wrong. Science. If you don't correct those mistakes, you're doing it really wrong. Science. If you can't accept that you're mistaken, you're not doing it at all.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by EcoStruct. For 15 years, helping homeowners add or remodel existing space with solar power and water systems, radiant heat, and other sustainable solutions. Information about EcoStruct's service and photos of past projects are at ecostruction.com, ecostruction.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. We're both geeks, and we can help you with your computer problems, or you can just join in with the discussion we've been talking about. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Or Miles, while we wait for calls to come in, at 1-800-655-5877. Let's go ahead and do your next news story, if you wouldn't mind.
One of the problems in the developing world especially, but also in other areas where you just may not be as close to civilization as you need at that moment. You're out hiking and you don't have a water faucet of potable water, you know, handy.
That happens a lot when you go hiking.
Yeah. Water sterilizers in general are very important. However, they can also be either very expensive or they don't last very long. Mm. You know, if you have a charcoal water filter, you know, you got to replace those on a regular basis. So those aren't really useful for a developing country where it's like, we got to keep buying these things.
Right.
So what some scientists at UC Berkeley have found is that you can use ionized plasmas like you would find in a neon sign or things like that. You know, Las Vegas would be a great, you know, sterilizer.
Finally a use.
Or a plasma TV. And you can make it antimicrobial. In other words, you can not only kill the bacteria that is already in the water, but you can make that water have certain antimicrobial properties so that bacteria have a hard time getting root in, taking root again for another week.
Interesting.
And making a plasma doesn't take that much power. And
how do you interact the water with the plasma?
Well, you'd have to read the paper. Uh-huh. And we will be giving a link over to sciencedaily.com, and you can read more about this.
All of this you can find up on geekspeak.org. Assuming the internet doesn't take our domain.
But what they were finding when they posted it to the Journal of Physics D Applied Physics, it found that the water treated with this plasma killed essentially all of the E. coli bacteria dumped into it within a few hours.
Wait, the water that was treated with this then killed bacteria?
The water that had the E. coli bacteria dumped into it was killed within a few hours by having the plasma treatment put onto it, essentially killing it, a full treatment of it, killing it all. And still, 99.9% of the E. coli did not come back after 7 days.
Very cool. So it really made that water better.
Right. E. coli being the things that the disease that has caused so many problems, either through lettuce because there was runoff from a pig farm, or, you know.
Right. It's a very essential bacteria in the gut of mammals. But,
going in the other end is bad.
So the other thing that sounds great about this way of doing the water is that making a plasma really is just high voltage. Like, you add high voltage to stuff and it gets into that fourth state of matter. It becomes plasma. Mm-hmm. So very cool.
You hook a couple of bikes together with a few people running in tandem.
For a little tiny bit of water. Where you just have water trickling through. Yeah, I could see that. It's very cool. I mean, we've been doing similar things, you know, adding inert properties to water, or, you know, adding ozonating water is another way of doing this, right? You throw a whole bunch of ozone into the water, which is H3, and that...
O3.
O3, sorry. Hydrogen. What? O3, and get a non-attractive environment for life, right? Which is what you want. And then it dissipates, and it turns into O2.
It's a highly reactive, and so therefore will break apart organic molecules.
But it breaks down very quickly into oxygen and whatever the oxygen is bound to. So very, very easy. All right, we do have a call. I don't know who it is and all that because I'm lost in the world of the computer. Looks like from Santa Cruz we have Bruce. So, Bruce, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I on?
You are. You're on air. What's up?
Great. I've been a longtime PC user and recently bought a MacBook Pro.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to, you know, try to dive in, but also to kind of keep my feet in the PC world by installing Parallels on Mac. And I went ahead and bought and downloaded Windows 7 and installed my copy of Microsoft Office. So I'm kind of, you know, in both worlds. But my problem is that the PC that I am migrating from is an XP machine.
Okay.
So I went ahead and I did what Parallels wanted me to do, which was to completely install my old machine basically on a little USB hard drive and then put that onto the Mac.
Okay.
And what I'm stuck now is I can't seem to activate
that Parallels. Windows.
Yeah. I can't activate my Windows, my XP Windows.
Well, was it XP Home, and so it says it's not a registered copy, it's on a new computer.
What's happening? Is Parallels having a problem recognizing it as an operating system, or what actually
happens? No, Parallels is recognizing it. I see that it's taken, it boots up as Windows, and it's XP Professional.
Okay.
It was my company machine, it says, you know, you need to activate this, and when I go to activate it, it doesn't take. My 25-digit
because it's associated now with your old hardware.
Right.
Okay. So it's not, do they suggest going through a call to call them?
They did, and then they finally just, you know, say go to Microsoft, support.microsoft.com/PAG, which is about activation.
Yeah, that's what you got
to
do.
You have to do that. You have to go through that and reactivate. Now, see, your license of... So you bought a Windows Professional, Windows XP Professional from Microsoft. And when they did that, they gave you a number. And every time you activate Microsoft's Windows programs at this point, when you put those OSs in, it contacts Microsoft and says, I'm using this serial number with this machine information. And they go, okay, cool, you're totally good to go. Then
there's a cryptographic signature that goes along with it. You don't actually have to do it every single time.
Right. And what happens is... Once they see a certain level of installs of that one number, they go, you know what? This might not be a legal thing anymore. We might have a problem.
Actually, OEM installs of Windows XP, there is only one legal install.
Right.
Oh, yeah, because it's a Dell machine.
Yeah. Did you build this machine yourself?
No, it's Dell.
Yeah. So.
Well, so maybe the answer is yes, but it's bought from Dell.
What it might mean is you have to buy a new license for Microsoft. because
okay,
when
and
you...
I wouldn't be against that, mm-hmm. but I can't seem to. So here's what happens. This is another sort of catch 22. So I went to that website to see about validate now, except yep. I'm doing it from the Mac. And so when I say validate now, it says, hey, you know, you're on an operating system I don't recognize.
Right. When it gives you the error message in Windows that says you can't run this Windows anymore, you need to do the web. You need to access the website, their website, from that install, even though it says you can't use it anymore.
So you think I'll be able to at least get on?
You should be able to fire up IE8. Yeah.
You should be able to active, even though your machine is shut down. You can't run that Windows. It's locked down. You should be able to access and buy it at that point through that web,
okay.
through that OS.
If it's just buying another license, I'd be
unfortunately,
okay.
It probably is, yeah. And it has to do with how you bought the license originally. As Miles was saying, the OEM or Dell has a special arrangement with Windows or with Microsoft that says, these licenses that we're buying for this OS is only for this hardware. You can't transfer it. And Microsoft says, sounds good. And then years from now, you think you have an XP license. You don't really.
Although you can probably...
fight it.
Well, you can try to persuade them just... for example, talking about like your old Dell is dying, you need to get that information off somewhere.
Who do I need to persuade?
Microsoft.
It would be the support individual you'd be talking to with Microsoft, yeah.
So I would actually have someone on the phone.
Yeah, and the reason why I love that you have to try to get access to your old Windows and it's all locked down and difficult and all that. That's one of the reasons why we don't like Windows. It's like because of this exact problem and you're already migrating away from it and you're still having the problem. So sorry, Bruce. Good luck.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
One other thing you can try is just taking that hard drive and connecting it up to your Mac with an install of Windows 7, just using it as an NTFS drive.
Yeah.
That works without authenticating it.
So if you have Windows, you said you were buying Windows 7 for?
I have Windows 7 on the Mac.
Okay. Open up Windows 7 in Parallels on the Mac, then connect that USB and try to migrate your data over. Then you won't have to activate XP, and you might get your programs, and you'll definitely get your user files. Also, the Macintosh can migrate your content over too, and it will take all the stuff that it can deal with.
Right. The beauty possibly of this Parallels migration is that I'll have all my software, all my everything.
Yeah, you have your exact same configuration. Unfortunately, that will require a call to Microsoft.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That's Bruce from Santa Cruz. Also in Santa Cruz, we have Jerry. Jerry, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello. I'm calling about Mac Keeper. Do you know anything about that program?
Yeah, it supposedly cleans up your Macintosh for you and makes things better and cleaner.
There are really conflicting reviews on it.
Yeah.
On Mac Reviews, which has then got a Mac Keeper ad at the very top of it, it says it's great and it's affordable. And then if you look at the Mac User Reviews, there's a million that say this killed my Mac and all of that, and then it says...
Here's the baseline of it. None of the geeks use it. I don't regularly clean up my Macintosh.
You don't?
No. I rarely shut down my machine, which means it doesn't even do a lot of its scripts. I rarely deal with that. It's just not the problem. If you've got a problem on a Macintosh, it's most likely not old software installs and such.
Well, I actually do have a problem with that, but at the same time, that's from an operating install that has been migrated from
multiple
three
times.
Different machines and five different versions of the OS.
Yeah.
So
the big thing to do is when a new OS of what I do is every other OS or something on a Macintosh environment, when the new OS is released, every other one or so, I buy a new hard drive for my machine, take the old hard drive out, install fresh, and migrate content over. Then those applications that don't work, old content that have uninstalled, won't leave all these preference files and stuff. But it's really not going to, that's not going to be the reason. Like 90% of the reasons why your machine is slow and other things are happening is because of hardware related issues on a Macintosh. My perspective is. The other thing is you also definitely want to, if you've installed a lot of applications, you want to make sure those applications aren't running all the time by default. If they're not running all the time, then don't worry about it. If, let's say, just tons of preference files and settings files and stuff, you're not going to see that content affect your machine unless you have a hardware problem or you have a piece of software that's trying to access them or potentially at boot time to try to figure out what the settings are. It has to go through a little bit of that directory structure as it logs you in, if you will, or boots depending on if you're which library file you're dealing with. So what I would definitely do is not worry about Mac Keeper. And if there's people out there that say Mac Keeper's great and stuff, fine, let me hear a real scientific description of why it's so good, what it really does for you, and I can start believing it. But so far, I haven't seen a real cause for it.
Wow. And so...
Then again, they're not advertising on our website. So as soon as they start advertising our website, I might change my mind. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So don't do anything. Just let it keep going. And, I mean, I do shut down the programs that I'm not using.
Yeah, and the other thing is go take a look at what your startup stuff is inside your system preferences, accounts, user. There's a tab up there that's like startup items. Go look in there and see what's starting up when your machine is running. You'll notice that, like, probably Microsoft is running something, which if you use Word and such a lot, you probably want that Office thing to start up because it'll make those applications feel snappier. But if you don't use them very often, then disable that. And then virus scanning, of course, is very time-consuming on your machine. And I don't know how important
of
it is.
Questionable utility.
At this point, far. Yeah. Thank you, Jerry, for the call.
Good. Thank you so much for your help.
Take care. Bye. From Santa Cruz again. Only people from Santa Cruz? Come on, people. We're worldwide here. 800-655-5877. Barb from Santa Cruz. Hi.
Hi. This last few weeks, I had a video of a whale go viral. And I'm really having trouble managing it. I originally put it on Vimeo, and it went kind of viral overnight, so I took it off, and I said, well, I might as well try to monetize this, and I put it back up on YouTube and monetized it. But I failed to click on where if somebody were to copy it, you could monetize off of them copying your thing. And I thought, well, I'll just tell them, you know, copyright infringement. Mm-hmm. That was the theme of the show today. And I can't get back on to AdSense to put that option on because at this point, I probably way over 50 people have copied it. And it's just pretty time consuming. I was wondering if you had any insights because YouTube is this big entity that just...
So the issue is that you now have it set up. If people play your video, then you're going to make some ads.
Exactly as it is. I even had a copyright watermark put on it, and they're still doing it.
Right.
They'll take it off and put their name on it, or you know.
Yeah.
This
do a stop and assist on every YouTube video. You can visit it.
I've done that. It's just you know, every day there's like 10 or 12 more. You know.
Right. You could also check with YouTube. One of the things they do is they look for if the same video signature is put up, and looking for duplicates. That's actually a relatively simple thing for them to do. You might be able to work with them on doing that, but I don't know any contact information, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's very hard to control copyright material on the internet.
Yeah, if someone altered your video in some way, then it becomes harder to track, but if it's the exact same one, that should be a lot easier to get a takedown.
I gotta see this video. Where is it?
It's called Surfer Almost Swallowed by Whale. It was
cool. I'm gonna make a copy of it. and Barb is your YouTube account. I wonder if it's you or not. See, I see three of them, and it's all the same video. How difficult!
It's just you just can't get back in and readjust it if you wanted to.
But are you BQ in Barb 13?
That's it. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, we'll link to that one. So there's five more people that will get your video.
While you're at it, click on the ad.
Yeah, I see that the ad comes in. Okay. Well, I definitely think you should try to, if you're making any kind of money on this and such, I like that you've got the copyright in there, the watermark. I think what you should do is go and spend some time, you know, taking down the other ones and mention them. But it's one of those things where, you know, get an intern to do that for you.
I have six
million views.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Now, were you on a boat?
Yeah, I was on a kayak.
Wow. I think I saw a still of this at one point. Very cool. Well, thanks, Barb. And I love that there's videos from Santa Cruz going viral. I really appreciate you calling in. And good luck protecting your copyrighted material.
Yeah. All right, thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Should we take a call from SoCal? Let's do that, shall we?
Sure.
Hello, Anonymous.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
My question is about virus protection. I currently, I have had McAfee. It was free with my DSL, but my DSL is going up in price. So if I go to the cheaper DSL, since my, I don't need the high one because we've tested and the high one doesn't do any more than the middle one where I live.
Okay.
So if I go to the cheaper one, that I don't get free McAfee. So I'm looking into other virus protection and ideally free ones or ones that you would recommend if I'm having to pay. And if there's a way not to have to pay, or and what would be the better virus protection?
From the reports that I've seen from comparisons, side-by-side comparisons, the pay-for ones actually do perform a little bit better. For example, Kaspersky.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Could you?
We'll put this up on our website after the show, a nice list again. Actually, I think we can just link to a previous show that had it.
Your website is?
Geekspeak.org.
Right.
It's, Kaspersky.
For free ones, there's free AVG and Avast.
But see, that's the thing is that if you're on a Windows machine, you really care about what's going on, you kind of want to go and go ahead and pay for it. This is different than I used to feel about this. But their company, here's the deal, is that it's an arms race, right?
Yeah.
Like right now, there are people constantly working on cracking into your machine. They do everything they can because they can make a lot of money doing that. So you have a force of very, very smart people doing everything they can to attack you. So now, how do you defend against that the best? You could theoretically use that social-grown private or free space, and that might be pretty effective.
Well, they actually have a pay-for product there. It's kind of like get antivirus out there and then try to get you to upgrade to the pay-for product, which, you know, is a reasonable position to take. But
if you're on a Windows machine, you really do have to have virus protection software running. So we'll make a list of them. We like Kaspersky, right? Kaspersky right now. I think that's how you pronounce it, right?
Yeah, Kaspersky.
Kaspersky or Persky?
Kaspersky. Kaspersky.
Kaspersky.
Geekspeak.org.
Yeah, and there's also Norton Utilities. There's also McAfee.
Norton wrecked my computer when I first had one.
Yeah.
It wrecked my computer.
Yeah, virus protection can definitely slow your machine down. It is a difficult thing to deal with.
It slows everything. It just wouldn't let me. Norton was like
well,
the worst.
Good luck. Good luck on your next endeavor.
You recommend a page for one, and you've got one that you suggest on your
website. Check our website in about an hour.
Yep, about an hour, geekspeak.org. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
We're not going to have time to get to any more calls, unfortunately, because we're at the end of our wonderful program today. I did want to also cover some things. We're coming up on the new year relatively soon, and I've been thinking about those shows. If you got an idea for a show that you really want to hear in December, the end of the next month, the rest of the month, please do let us know. Geekspeak.org,
and we'll be able to give you a Christmas present of your topic of your show.
Yeah. One of the things I also want to make sure is people in the New Year's resolution space, you've got to figure out backups for your computer. It's just a matter of time, and you've got to get good passwords because there's enemies out there. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Green Space, specializing in sustainable solutions for home improvement and everyday living at 1122 Soquel Avenue in Santa Cruz, and online at greenspacecompany.com. Greenspace is proud to sponsor NPR News and Music on KOSP. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters drop-in quiet office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruiseio.com. For KOSP and for Geekspeak, my name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me was Miles Elam. Thanks, Miles, for doing Geekspeak with me.
Always a pleasure.
We'll be back next week, and Geekspeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. Until next week, this has been Geekspeak on KOSP.
And Joan from Carmel, if you look for Lost Inbox on Outlook on Google, it'll give you the answer.
Sweet.